this week's 51%, we hear from a critic of natural parenting.
Natural parenting is not about children. It's about women and how they want to view themselves.
A high school reporting project focuses on a transgender student and find out just how far good friends go to have a baby. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Good morning, starshine. The earth says hello. You twinkle above us. We twinkle below. Good morning, starshine. You lead us along.
In recent years, the natural parenting movement, which praises the virtues of birth without medical intervention, exclusive breastfeeding, and attachment parenting, has gained immense popularity in America and around the world. But it's not without controversy. It's a polarizing topic among parents, midwives, lactation consultants, and licensed medical practitioners, who are often at bitter odds over the birthing and parenting philosophy. Dr. Amy Tutur, a Harvard-educated obstetrician and author of the blog The Skeptical OB, has been one of the most vocal critics of the natural parenting movement. And her new book is called Pushback, Guilt in the Age of Natural Parenting, in which she questions the origins of the movement and takes issue with many of the claims that it makes about what is best for mother and child. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall spoke with her about her views.
Dr. Amy Tutur, welcome to 51%.
Thank you so much for having me.
You say many times in your book, Pushback, and on your blog that your main objective here is not to convince natural childbirth activists, lactivists, attachment parenting enthusiasts. It's not to change their minds, but you rather want to remove the guilt from motherhood. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I don't think I could remove all the guilt from motherhood, but at least the guilt around childbirth choices, breastfeeding, and whether or not to follow the tenets of attachment parenting.
Now, let's talk about this guilt a little bit. Where does it come from?
I think that it comes from an effort to control women. Sometimes that effort is explicit, as in what the founders of these movements intended. Sometimes it's more subtle. But the end result is that these movements combine to force women back into the home.
Where did natural childbirth, where did this all come from?
Well, I have to tell you that when I first looked into it, I was surprised by what I found. Grantley DeGreed was a eugenicist. He was an obstetrician. He promulgated his theories in the 1930s. He was very worried about the idea that white women of what he called the better classes were not having as many children as primitive women. And he thought that was because they were becoming diverted by the quest for political and economic rights. And his idea was, and I think he believed it, even though he made it up, was that primitive women, by which he meant women of color, did not experience pain in childbirth because they understood that their job was to have children. And white women who had gotten educated and become what he called over-civilized, their ovaries had shriveled. They developed the disease of hysteria, and hyster is actually Latin for uterus, and they developed pain in childbirth. So if they went back to being women the way he believed they should be, they would be rewarded with painless childbirth.
So how did a message like that go from, you know, what it was, kind of a patriarchal thing, to a emblem of feminism today? How did it evolve?
Well, first of all, the current leaders in the natural childbirth industry don't mention it, but it evolved in a really interesting way. I mean, one of the things that resonated with many women is that Grantley DeGreed believed that women should be awake and aware for childbirth. And that was a time where medicine was really patriarchal. Doctors were putting women to sleep to give birth, and women wanted to be awake. So some of the original goals of the natural childbirth movement really dovetailed with what women wanted. And in fact, the natural childbirth movement changed as it crossed the Atlantic. And in the United States, it became much more about having control over birth, being awake for birth, having your partner with you during labor. You know, the natural childbirth movement did a lot of great things in the 60s and 70s. They went to hospitals and they said, you know, women want to have their husbands with them in labor. And the doctor said, oh, well, you know, we can't possibly have that. And the natural childbirth movement said, well, why not? And the doctor said, well, because, ooh, I guess there really isn't any reason. And so fathers were in the delivery room. And so they affected a lot of very positive changes. And by the early 1980s, they basically could have declared victory and gone home. But as we know from organizational psychology, big organizations do not put themselves out of business. So they move the goalposts and reframe the goals. What originally was about being awake during childbirth, now that the epidural was available and women could be awake, aware, in control, and without pain, the new goalpost was to have no pain relief in childbirth. And everything was about trying to recapitulate childbirth as they believed it had been in nature. And that resonated with a certain group of people who really were looking for what they considered to be authentic experiences and really felt that natural childbirth was making them more like their revered foremothers. The big problem, though, is that natural childbirth actually has very little relationship to childbirth in nature, because childbirth in nature is often deadly.
What about lactivism and attachment parenting?
They were separate things, but they were related. La Leche League was started by a group of seven devout Catholic women in the late 1950s who were very distressed that mothers of small children were going to work. And they reasoned that Mary, Mother of Jesus, would never have gone to work because she would have been breastfeeding. And they felt that by promoting breastfeeding, they could get more women to stay home. And at their first national conference, the guest speaker was Grantley Dick Reed. And on their website, you can't find evidence of what the original history was, but people wrote about it at the time and subsequently, so that's what the history was. And one of their first directors of pediatrics was Dr. Bill Sears, who invented attachment parenting. Or actually, he didn't really invent it. He kind of copied it from what some of the women in the La Leche League movement believed. And once again, the origins are somewhat obscure, but I went back and found some of the Sears' first books before they became commercially popular. And one of the first ones was entitled something like The Christian Guide to Parenting and Child Care. And in it, they revealed that they believed that the idea of attachment parenting had been given to them by God through prayer, because it was his design for how to organize the family. The husband should be the head, and the wife should be subservient, and her only concern should be dealing with children's issues. So all three movements were about controlling women, but they sold themselves ultimately as giving women control.
Now, how do you see things playing out in the future? I mean, the fight between obstetricians and midwives obviously goes back a long way. And then even before modern obstetrics, there was always some kind of a, you know, battle or roller coaster trends in childbirth. Is the attachment parenting, natural childbirth, lactivist movement, is that like a bubble that's going to burst and then we're going to, you know, sort of sway to the other side? Or how do you see that playing out?
Well, I see these movements really as backlash to the emancipation of women. You know, one of the greatest changes in the 20th century was that women, or by that I mean some women in some countries, finally attained political and economic rights. And that was brand new. For all of human history, women had been subservient, and they had been judged on the function of their reproductive organs. Their only value was being there for sex, giving birth, and raising children. And the emancipation of women finally gave women a chance to use their intellect and their talents and their character in ways that they never could before. And a seismic shift like that never happens without backlash. But I think going forward in my daughter's generation and future generations, I think women will reject that backlash and will reclaim their place in the wider world. And they'll be more clear-eyed about what the people are marketing these movements are actually trying to do. Now, I mean, one thing I really want to emphasize is there's nothing wrong with unmedicated vaginal birth, and there's nothing wrong with breastfeeding, and there's nothing wrong with attachment parenting. In fact, I had 4 vaginal births and 2 with epidurals and 2 without. I breastfed all 4 of my children, and although the terminology didn't exist then, I could have been labeled an attachment parent. But that's because those choices worked for me and my children. That didn't make me a better mother than anybody else. There are other excellent ways to raise children. The most important thing about raising children is loving them and letting them know it. And these details of process, like natural childbirth and breastfeeding and attachment parenting, they don't mean much to children at all.
How can women help women? How can they help them get over the guilt of parenting and sort of get to that message that you just described about, you know, it's all about loving the children and you know, letting them know that they're loved? How can women help women?
Well, that's going to be hard because of the natural dynamics of social groups. I like to say that, you know, remember those girls in junior high school who wouldn't let you sit at their cafeteria table?
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're now down at the playground criticizing the way you gave birth. And I don't really understand why middle school girls always have cliques, but they always do. And they always try to make themselves feel better by excluding other people or demeaning their choices. In middle school, it's, you know, what you wear and do you have designer handbags. And in the childbearing years, it's what kind of birth did you have and how long did you breastfeed? To me, these things are intimate questions. I mean, asking a woman whether or not she had an epidural or a vaginal birth is like asking, you know, pads or tampons. like, why do you think you have a right to know? And yet, there is this tendency of people who want to make themselves feel better by making other people feel bad. Natural parenting is not about children. It's about women and how they want to view themselves.
In this whole process, throughout your blog and now writing your book, like, you've encountered a lot of people with strong opinions, I'm sure, made some enemies.
Oh, yes.
Do you ever really get frustrated?
Well, I might, except for something that my readers don't see, which is that I get a tremendous amount of private email and Facebook messages. They write to me and they say things like, you know, I found your website in the middle of the night when I was up with my screaming baby Googling, am I a bad mother? And I mean, I've gotten many, many messages that start off something like that. And then they say, you know, and I found your website and all of a sudden I realize, what am I doing? You know, why am I worried about these things? Why aren't I enjoying my baby? Why am I letting these other women tell me whether or not I'm good? Although I get a lot of public, you know, nasty comments and so forth, it really is, you know, dramatically outweighed by the private positive feedback. When somebody writes to me and says, I realized, wait a second here, I don't have to do it this way. I can do it the way that feels best for me. And I'm a much happier mother, and my baby is actually much happier.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today on 51%.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Amy Tutur speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall about her new book, Pushback, Guilt in the Age of Natural Parenting. Over the last couple of years, the Cheektowaga Central High School has participated in PBS NewsHour student reporting labs. Cheektowaga is a nearby suburb of Buffalo, New York. And as WBFO's Focus on Education reporter Eileen Buckley discovered, this year the students produced a story about a transgender high school student.
I was, like, really curious as to, like, how that all works with being transgender.
Tatiana Moses is a senior. She was one of the 4 student producers who created a video of their classmate DJ Morley, once a boy known as Dalton. Morley is finishing up her second year at the high school. She identifies herself as transgender.
I realized I was transgender when I was younger, around the age of like 5, but I never really knew what it was called.
That's Morley speaking in the student-produced video. The day we visited the high school to meet with her and classmates, Morley called in sick. However, students gave us permission to access their video work for her story.
You know that you're like, okay, I want to be a female, but at the time I didn't know, like, that was called trans.
Students in this project learned about Morley's confidence and how it has strengthened her to live as a teenage girl. Deja Vu Romer is also a Cheektowaga High School senior.
At first it was kind of like shocking, but then when I thought about it, I'm like, I mean, everything's changing now in society, like, it's not that big of a shock to me. She changes in a girl's locker room, but it doesn't bother me. Like, I see her as a female, not as a male.
I had a doctor, Dr. Mazur, who basically sat me down, and I didn't know what trans was at the time. I didn't know the meaning of it or trans was a thing. So when we talked about it and we discussed, you know, my feelings and how I thought and the way I saw the world and how I saw myself when I was older, he basically looked at me and said, you know, you're transgender, this is like your title.
The students told WBFO News there seems to be much attention surrounding the transgender issue, so they wanted to focus on the topic. Senior Validia Jones was excited to work on the project because she knew nothing about Morley.
I got to see like what she goes through and everything. And
what does she go through?
Like, she gets a lot of bad feedback and she gets a lot of good, and then like her with her families, they were supportive and everything.
Senior Kenitra Redfern says they visited Morley's house and met with her parents to learn about the transgender youth and her life.
What did you learn?
I learned that even though they're like transgender, like they're still people too, like they still have feelings.
When DJ came out and said that she was transgender, obviously we asked her, are you sure, or is this something that you're thinking about? Mm-hmm. Are you sure this is something that you want?
My childhood was normal.
I think her parents see her as a strong individual. Like they don't have a son, but they have a strong, beautiful daughter, so.
I feel like it was a lot easier for them because, like she said, she had older brothers who grew up gay as well. So, like, it wasn't just her.
I actually seen her transformation. She came from, like, her freshman year. Everybody was just like, oh, well, you know, that's a boy. She's just gay. That's all they just said, oh, yeah, you're gay and stuff like that. And then, like, as the year went on, she started wearing heels. And I'm like, well, people are saying she's gay, but she's starting to look like a female to me, so. And then this year it was like, bam, I'm transgender, call me DJ.
I showed up with my hair curled, my makeup fully done, all girl clothes. And I did not look like myself. And I was scared, but my mom looked at me and said, you know, if you're happy, you're happy. If they don't like it, put on a smile and walk sassily away in your heels.
I was initially nervous when they chose this topic because it has been so, I mean, at that point in time, it was just coming out as a big issue in a lot of communities that were close to us.
Cheektowaga High School teacher Joe Malley leads the student reporter project.
I don't think it really helps kids look into questions that everybody knows the answers of already. I mean, here's this issue and our entire society is coming to terms with it. And here are four extremely bright adolescents, you're really digging into this very interesting and complicated topic and doing it with grace and respect and dignity. It's been great to watch.
The four student producers say they've actually gained a new girlfriend through this project. They bonded with Morley.
I feel like we helped her and she helped us in a way. And like we kind of like helped society figure things out as well.
The students say a lesson learned is not to judge someone. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
How far would you go to help a good friend? It's a question two Boulder, Colorado couples spent a year and a half considering and came up with some pretty unconventional answers. As we approach Mother's Day, we visit a report from KUNC's Grace Hood on the final steps of a journey that started from one person's medical misfortune.
Sarah Megabo slides her petite frame onto an exam room table in a well-lit but cramped doctor's office.
Are you feeling the baby move?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Good.
She's uncomfortable, at 8 months, visibly pregnant.
This is the painless part.
The grip of a blood pressure cuff is painless compared to what Sarah has endured just to get here. A daily regimen of hormonal injections and a surgical procedure to implant two fertilized eggs into her uterus.
120 over 70.
So far, everything's going according to plan.
All right, well, do you guys have questions today?
That's obstetrician Dr. Tracy Jones. She's directing that question not only to Sarah, but to the baby's parents, Mindy and Forrest Kelly.
Can you tell if he's turned upside down yet?
I can try to feel, yeah.
In the medical field, Sarah's what's known as a gestational carrier, but she's a rare exception in this extremely uncommon circumstance. Unlike many women who become carriers, Sarah's not getting paid, and she's not a blood relative of the parents. She's simply a friend.
I feel like this baby has been waiting for Mindy and Forrest, and he just needed an oven. You know, so I'm not necessarily giving anything. I'm like babysitting for 9 months.
Can I nuke this for like 10 seconds?
I thought you meant the Coke.
At the home of Sarah and Mark Megabo, the two couples share pizza and some laughs. But 4 years ago, these lighthearted moments were harder to come by. That's because doctors had re-diagnosed Mindy with stage 3B breast cancer, and the mastectomy that she needed would make her sterile.
And I had no children, and of course, Horace and I wanted them.
Mindy's doctor sent her to a fertility specialist who harvested, fertilized, and froze her eggs for the day that she could carry a baby. But last July, she found out that would not be possible because pregnancy would reintroduce hormones that could trigger her cancer.
And as my doctor said, it would be very bad, life-threatening. And I was devastated and spent my day crying. And
then, you know, I remember that day. It seemed like a really long day.
A day that got even longer for Forrest Kelly when he showed up for an evening rehearsal with the all-male vocal rock band Face, which includes his longtime friend, Mark Megabo.
He couldn't stay very long because I needed him to come home. And he told the guys what was going on, and Sarah was there.
Driving home, Sarah told Mark that she wanted to carry Mindy's baby.
It was just, you really want to do that? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, okay.
And then the next morning, probably 10 o'clock, Sarah called and said that she would do it. I want a girl with
the right allocations. Mindy and I aren't sisters necessarily, but we're very, very close. And so it's been a pretty natural extension of our relationship to share this sort of intimacy. I want a girl with a short skirt and a long
jacket. As well as the husbands harmonize on stage, pulling four people into this offstage act has been a bit more complicated. The couples had to go shopping for health and life insurance plans, and then there was the 40-page legal contract.
It says that Sarah, that she won't do things while she's pregnant, like she won't drink, that she will take care of the baby, go to the doctor regularly.
Sarah sums it up this way.
It was a really, really long contract that basically said that when the baby comes out, I'm giving it up.
Now that she's almost ready to give birth, it's a question a lot of people are asking. Is she ready to give up the baby when it's time?
That has never really been a sticking point for me. I mean, of course I'm prepared for postpartum depression, but I'm also going to be a part of their lives for a long time, so I'll see him be raised in a healthy and wonderful home.
One of the final papers to be signed by the couples is the birthing agreement. Mindy, Forrest, Mark, and Sarah recently crowded around the Megabo's kitchen table to review the document. Mindy says they're expecting the delivery room staff to be a little thrown off by four parents and multiple sets of grandparents.
They'll know exactly who's allowed in the room and that Forrest and I are the parents.
They'll cut the umbilical cord and be handed the baby first.
All right, well, Sarah's at the top here. Shall you sign?
Forrest hands the pen to Sarah, then they all take turns.
Does this mean we're like the four of us are common law married now or something?
Hasn't that already been the case?
It may not be marriage, but it's a bond that all agree will be there for life. For KUNC, I'm Grace Hood.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. Percent is spelled out. This week's show is number 1397.